We welcome you to VOA Asia Weekend. Over the next 60 minutes, you'll hear the top stories from our daily VOA Asia program. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. A political crisis in Sri Lanka took a deadly turn Sunday, with one person killed when a sacked cabinet member tried to re-enter his office days after the president removed the prime minister and installed a powerful ally of China in his place. Joining us on VOA Asia is Taylor Dibbert. He's a freelance writer who has spent many years working and living in Sri Lanka. Taylor, thanks for being with us. This is a very complicated story. Can you help us make sense out of it?
There's a dispute over who the actual prime minister of Sri Lanka is. And ideally, this is going to be decided. Of course, this situation is far from ideal, but it could be decided in parliament. It could be decided in court. But there's an element of this that, you know, it's possible some of this stuff could be decided in the street. I mean, it could get very nasty. There could be threats, intimidation, or worse. There's been a coalition government since 2015, which is based upon an alliance between the two main political parties, the Sri Lanka Freedom Party and the United National Party. So on Friday, Sirisena announced that his allies would be leaving the coalition. And he also stated that the country's previous president, Mahinda Rajapaksa, would be appointed prime minister, and that the current prime minister, Ranil Wickremesinghe, would no longer be in his post, which is completely unconstitutional. And, I mean, this is absolutely an illegitimate and lawless power grab.
Was there any expectation of these moves?
So I don't think anyone was predicting that this would happen. I mean, it was no secret that the relationship between Sirisena and Wickremesinghe had become increasingly dysfunctional. The government was elected to do various things, ranging from economic reform to anti-corruption to constitutional reform to they added transitional justice later. I mean, almost none of that has happened, really. It's been a major disappointment. And meanwhile, Rajapaksa, who ruled the country from 2005 to 2015, unexpectedly lost a presidential election in January of 2015. And at that time, or in the weeks before that, Sirisena came out of nowhere to challenge him as this common candidate, claiming that he was going to return the country to some semblance of democracy. And you know, Rajapaksa had really taken things in a very bad and dark direction, and Sirisena had promised to change that. Of course, he's completely, I mean, now, in realigning with Rajapaksa, it kind of shows you that Sirisena probably didn't think he had anywhere else to go.
What's the situation on the ground there now?
I think it's very, I mean, one, the situation is very fluid. I mean, I think, you know, things might look different in 1 day or 2 days or 3 days. It's not clear what's going to happen next, but I think there's a sense of chaos, but there's also a sense of fear, I think, especially like in the north and east, that you know, Mahinda Rajapaksa rules the country. Sirisena has been a disappointment for sure, but he's not the authoritarian that Mahinda Rajapaksa is. So in terms of space for dissent, I mean, that's improved significantly under Sirisena. Reducing authoritarianism is also a lot better. Of course, what Sirisena is doing now is very authoritarian. So I think any context in which Mahinda Rajapaksa is returns to the highest levels of power, whether it's this illegal means, or I know people were concerned about him or one of his allies, potentially his brother, running in the next presidential election and winning. I mean, this is a disaster. It's really negative.
What role does China play in this?
All right, there are two people now saying that they're the prime minister of Sri Lanka. And relatedly, I think a lot of reporting has wanted to focus on the geopolitical angle. I mean, yes, the Chinese are happy if Mahinda Rajapaksa is in power. Absolutely. And I think this is principally a Sri Lankan problem. Right, that is probably going to require Sri Lankan solutions.
But China has and continues to play a large role in the country. Is that not correct?
China does play a large role in the country. I mean, China was, I think, Sirisena, one of the things when he campaigned for president was he promised a more balanced foreign policy. And, you know, it's become increasingly clear that there is a limit to how much he can walk back some of what Rajapaksa did in terms of, you know, all these loans that will need to be repaid in the coming years and all these development projects that have already gotten going. So the Chinese do have leverage, but, I mean, the U.S. and other countries have leverage, too. I mean, for example, Sri Lanka has been very happy with this flurry of increased bilateral military cooperation between the U.S. and Sri Lanka, including some military financing. The U.S. government is about to sign a Millennium Challenge Compact with Sri Lanka, which is a major five-year grant, but that's going to need to be re-examined now if this kind of illegal move is allowed to stand.
Taylor Dibbitt, thank you so much for being with us. By the way, Rajapaksa crushed the decades-long Tamil Tiger uprising in Sri Lanka when he was in power, but he's refused to acknowledge abuses committed during that bloody civil war. The U.S. State Department has called on both sides to act in accordance with Sri Lanka's constitution, refrain from violence, and follow due process. The Bangladesh government is working to turn a muddy, uninhabited island in the Bay of Bengal into a place that can house roughly 100,000 Rohingyas who've sought refuge in the country after fleeing Myanmar following the military crackdown there. But questions remain whether Bashanchar Island will be suitable for so many people to live. VOA's Muazzam Hussein Shakil filed this report from Cox's Bazar, narrated by Bejan Hamdard.
Hundreds of thousands of Rohingyas have escaped Myanmar into Bangladesh, leaving behind their homes and personal belongings. While they freed themselves from brutal conditions, living in refugee camps in Bangladesh has come with new challenges. With the assistance of the international community, the Bangladesh government is building a housing development in the remote Bashanchar Island. The island, which rose from the sea in 2006, is about an hour boat ride from the mainland, and is vulnerable to violent weather. Members of the international community are urging all technical requirements be made to make the island safe before the Rohingya refugees are relocated.
We expect that the United Nations will be making a full technical assessment of the island. I think that as long as the Rohingya have the right to voluntarily participate in this program to move to Bashanchar and that the technical requirements are met, the international community would be supportive. But this is a process that's still under consideration and under study.
Months behind schedule, the development is in its final stages of completion. But most refugees are skeptical about relocating. Some environmentalists warn that a typhoon or any other natural disaster could cause severe damage to the island. But a top Bangladesh official in charge of refugee relief, Mizanur Rahman, says the new housing settlement will provide the Rohingyas with better living conditions.
Eight individual families can live in each side of these cluster homes. Each building will have one community kitchen and community shower facilities. Each kitchen comes with 16 cookers. The kitchens are made of bricks and tin. The walls are made of bricks and the roof is made of tin.
Bangladesh is one of the lowest-lying countries in the world. In the last 50 years, hundreds of thousands of people have died from natural disasters in Bangladesh, particularly in the coastal areas near Bashanchar Island. For Muazzam Hussein Shakil in Cox's Bazar, Bangladesh, this is Bejan Hamdard, VOA News.
An invitation from India to the President of the United States might signify some problems in the relationship between India and the United States. We welcome to VOA Asia Michael Kugelman, South Asia expert for the Woodrow Wilson Center in Washington. Michael, what's this all about?
So several months back, as I understand it, the Indian government and Prime Minister Narendra Modi specifically had invited President Trump to go to India in January to join Modi for what is called the Republic Day celebrations in India, which is essentially a big holiday in India where the country celebrates India. And typically India extends an invitation to a foreign guest, a very high-profile foreign guest, to join Modi at a big parade that takes place in which all of India's most powerful weaponry and military equipment is paraded down Main Boulevard. So it's a very prestigious type of invitation. Barack Obama, when he was president of the U.S. Back in 2015, he accepted an invitation from Modi, and he was there for that. And Japan's prime minister, Abe, has been there. So it's a pretty big deal. But then we heard several days ago, as I understand it, the U.S. government essentially said no, that Trump would not be able to go. This has not been confirmed or denied by either the Indian or the American governments. But according to the Indian press, President Trump is unable to attend because it simply is a busy time for his domestic schedule, particularly as this trip would fall right around the time of the State of the Union address, which is in January. So to emphasize, it hasn't yet been this has not yet been confirmed by the American or the Indian government. So I think that there's good reason to think that Trump indeed will not be going, simply because there's been quite a lot of reports from around India.
A report? What kind of reports? I mean, what is the relationship, as you can see it, between the U.S. and India now, in relation to what it has been in the immediate past?
Well, it's interesting because the U.S.-India relationship has really been taking off in a big way, really over the last decade and a half. I go back to, you have to go back to the early 1990s when India started liberalizing its economy and opening itself up to the world after being quite close to the Soviet Union during the Cold War. But really over the last 10 or 15 years, the U.S. and India have really moved closer together as they've realized that they both share a very strong interest in counterbalancing the rise of China in Asia. And so during the Obama administration, the relationship grew significantly. And even the beginning of the Trump administration, we saw a lot of forward movement in the U.S.-India relationship. Trump hosted Modi for a visit at the White House soon after Trump took office, which went very well. But then things have changed. I've got to say that there have been some new tension points that have cropped into the relationship, and the main one being that India is close to two countries that Trump administration is not close to. One is Russia, the other is Iran. India depends on Russia as a key source of arms, and India depends on Iran as a key source of energy, of oil imports. And, of course, the Trump administration has recently passed sanctions on Russia and on Iran. It basically says that it would penalize anyone that tries to do business with Russia and Iran. And that's exactly what the Indians keep doing. And so that's become a really big tension point in the relationship. And there are some that have suggested that perhaps if India had done as the U.S. had asked it to do, let's say if India had decided to stop importing oil from Iran, and if India had stopped deciding to import arms from Russia, neither of which India has done, that perhaps Trump would have been willing to accept this invitation to go to India to meet with Prime Minister Modi in January. I'm not sure if that's the case, but there's something to be said for that. So the bottom line is that the U.S.-India relationship has really enjoyed a lot of forward movement over the last decade or so and really over the last few years. But over the last few months, it's really hit some major obstacles, and I think at this point, it's really struggling just a bit.
What do you think the possibility is that since neither side has announced any rejection to the invitation, that the Trump administration is kind of using that as a bargaining chip as far as Iran and Russia and India are concerned?
Yeah, I mean, it certainly is a possibility. Now, of course, it's not too late to think that in not too long from now, there could be some type of formal message or indication from the U.S. government that the trip is not going to happen. But absolutely, I mean, we hear so often that the Trump administration, particularly Trump himself, are transactional types, that they're always looking to make decisions based on deals and, you give me something, I'll give you something. So, perhaps there's an effort to use this this whole invitation thing is some type of bargaining chip. But quite frankly, I think that this trip is not going to happen. My own view is that Trump never would have been interested in attending. You know, I should say that when you agree to attend these Republic Day festivities with Prime Minister Modi, it basically entails sitting outside for a number of hours, 6-7 hours. And, you know, in India, it has some of the worst air pollution in the world. It could be pretty difficult and boring for someone. And President Trump, I think, is not given to wanting to sort of sit outside in bad air quality for a long time, particularly when he's not in his own country. So I think for purely logistical considerations, it would have been a long shot to assume that Trump would have wanted to do something like this.
Michael Kugelman, South Asia expert for the Woodrow Wilson Center in Washington. We continue now. It was reported recently that microplastics, both in the ocean and in the plastic all around us, is finding its way into the human body. But the convenience and affordability of plastic means that for now, the best we can hope for to deal with the problem is to improve recycling efforts. Indonesia's second largest city is trying to do just that by offering free rides on the city's bus system in return for plastic trash. More from VOA's Kevin Enix.
In Surabaya, Indonesia, you can often see people walking to their local bus stop carrying bags of plastic trash. That's because at local bus stations, that trash can be exchanged for bus tickets.
We can reduce trash so it doesn't pile up at home because we just can't bring it here and make good use of it. It's a win-win situation.
Here's how the system works. 10 plastic cups or 5 plastic bottles are good for a 2-hour bus ticket. It doesn't seem like a lot, but the plastic piles up quickly, and every bit helps because Indonesia as a whole has a big plastic problem.
Indonesia is one of the biggest contributors in the world for plastic waste, and through this initiative, we hope to raise public awareness on the environment, especially issues that relate to plastic trash.
All this waste is then separated and auctioned off to recycling companies. The Plastic for Tickets plan is part of an ambitious nationwide initiative called Zero Waste Indonesia 2020. Kevin Enix, VOA News.
No one knows for sure when yaks were first domesticated, but it's likely that they were first bred thousands of years ago as beasts of burden for the caravans of Himalayan trade routes. The massive, hairy, ox-like creatures are found in the high mountains of Central Asia, where they provide meat, milk, hides, and labor. But as VOA's Tibetan Service reporter Yeshi Dorje tells us, they are increasingly finding new homes in America's high country. Mil Arcega narrates.
You're more likely to find these long-haired beasts of burden grazing in the highlands of the Tibetan Plateau. But these domesticated yaks have gained a new foothold far from home, in Colorado's high country. These American-born yaks are descendants of the first herds brought to American ranches about 30 years ago. Today, they occupy a steadily growing niche in American agriculture.
Yaks are definitely a growing industry in the United States right now. I can't tell you exactly how many yak farms or ranches there are in the United States. IYAC, International Yak Association, does have over 200 members.
Got our first 3 yak we started with, and went from there.
The Petty Ranch started raising yaks in Fairplay, Colorado 2 decades ago, and for good reason. Danielle Garner says yak meat tastes better than beef, and it's healthier because it has less fat.
Mother's side of the family has a lot of heart issues.
It's been beneficial for her. It's reduced cholesterol.
Oh, yes.
The health benefit for her has been substantial.
We have done studies. We did it through Michigan State University and Silk Air and Company, and we have proven that yak is the only thing actually lowering cholesterol is turkey.
Aside from the health benefits, yaks are also better for the environment because they need less land for grazing than cattle. And their fur is a favorite among designers because it's silkier and more durable than cashmere. For farmers, it's all money in the bank.
Our primary business is selling high-quality breeding stock to other breeders.
Montana rancher Jim Watson started replacing his cattle and bison herds for yaks back in 2003. Since then, he's sold about 500 of them to other ranchers. Besides their meat, these yaks can be used as pack animals for trekking, and some are even sold as pets.
Yaks are much smarter than cattle, and they have richer personalities. You fall in love with them more.
It's their characters. They each have their own individual personality.
Despite their charming demeanor, yak farming has its limits. The animals thrive at higher elevations and colder environments. And at an altitude of 3,000 meters, the Petty Ranch has been an ideal home for these Tibetan newcomers. But as the western sun sets over the Mosquito Mountains of Colorado, some ranch owners remind us that in the land of cattle and buffalo, it's just a dawn of yak farming. For producer Yeshi Dorji in Fairplay, Colorado, Millar Sega, VOA News.
Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe has engaged in big power diplomacy, hosting Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi after a three-day summit in China and meetings with senior officials, including President Xi Jinping. In Beijing, Mr. Abe signed an $18 billion business deal as well as a $30 billion currency swap pact as a way to enhance trade and support financial markets. Yoichiro Sato is a professor of international strategic studies at the Ritsu Meikin Asia Pacific University in Japan. He told VOA's Victor Beatty the Japan-India summit aimed at a free and open Indo-Pacific region is significant.
For Modi, the visit to Japan is after 2 years since the last time and his third time. And Abe received Modi with utmost reception by taking him to a nice resort town in the central part of Japan. And they had a very productive meeting about reassuring their mutual commitment to the free and open Indo-Pacific, which has become kind of a central keyword for the Abe administration these days.
Can we say this meeting is kind of a counterweight to China?
It's definitely a way to counterbalance China's effort, especially the Maritime Belt Initiative, which China has been conducting in the very same Indo-Pacific region.
It comes just a day after he came back from Beijing with a fairly successful summit there.
Yes, in fact, it's been reported that Abe briefed Modi about his meeting with China. So I guess part of that is to reassure Modi that the Abe's meeting with the Chinese leaders does not mean significant recourse of Japan's strategic orientation.
Interesting that India and Japan are going to hold their first joint military exercises involving ground troops next month.
Yes, this is very significant. The two countries have been engaging themselves in joint maritime exercises for some 10, 11 years. I think the first Japanese participation in the Operation Malabar military naval exercise was in 2007, and Japan has been frequent participant in this exercise. But the ground troop cooperation is new development.
Well, this comes, as I said, on the heels of this rather historic meeting between top Chinese officials and Prime Minister Abe, forging deals totaling $18 billion, also a $30 billion currency swap pact. This is being described as a historic turning point in the relations between these two former enemies, was it?
In Japan, the significance of the bilateral meeting has been somewhat downplayed, and the Japanese government has been busy explaining the currency swap in terms of the interest of Japanese banks in China rather than the interest of China per se.
Are trade tensions involving both countries with the United States driving them together, do you think?
They have announced that they would like to jointly promote free trade. This indeed is a very subtle response to the Trump administration's leaning toward protectionism. But they avoided using the word protectionism because that will really imply the United States as a kind of common problem for them. I think they kind of diluted the language by using the promotion of free trade.
The two countries, once bitter enemies in World War II, reestablished relations in 1972 and are marking 40 years of a friendship treaty. President Xi said bilateral ties have returned to the right track and China will ensure the positive momentum continues. Mr. Abe invited him to visit Japan next year, but the Japanese leader also cautioned there could be no genuine improvement in bilateral ties unless there was stability in the East China Sea. Yoichiro Sato said, unfortunately, even as the two leaders met, another Chinese patrol vessel violated the contiguous waters around disputed islands known in Japan as Senkaku and in China as Dieu. Indonesian officials say there are likely no survivors after a Lion Air flight with 189 passengers and crew on board crashed into the sea Monday, 13 minutes after taking off from Jakarta. We heard more from AP correspondent Charles de Ledesma.
Lion Air says the jet, on a 1 hour and 10 minute flight from Jakarta to an island close to Sumatra, was carrying 181 passengers, including one child and two babies, and eight crew members. Indonesia's disaster agency has posted photos online of a crushed smartphone, books, bags, and parts of the aircraft fuselage that had been collected by search and rescue vessels. The weather conditions were normal, but the brand new aircraft had experienced a technical issue on its previous flight. The crash is a blow to the country's aviation safety record after the lifting of bans on its airlines by the EU and the US.
Indonesian search and rescue teams recovered debris, including body parts, personal belongings, and parts of the aircraft from what is believed to be the scene of the crash. Officials said that among the passengers were one child and two babies. Italian pro cyclist Andrea Manfredi died in the crash, according to reports in local and Italian media. Several bodies are reported to have been recovered. At a news briefing last Monday, Search and Rescue Operation Director Bambung Suryo Aji said they believe most of the crash victims were still in the plane underwater. The search and rescue agency deployed divers in their search for the main wreckage of the plane that crashed north of Java Island. The plane went down in waters about 30 meters to 35 meters deep, about 15 kilometers off the coast. The Lion Air flight, JT610, would have landed in the capital of the Bangka Belitung tin mining region at 7:20 a.m. local time, according to Flight Radar 24 website. The accident is the first reported that involves a Boeing 737 MAX, an updated, widely sold aircraft that is more fuel efficient. The plane maker said on a tweet that it was aware of the accident and was closely monitoring the situation. Australia wants to ban refugees that have been detained after arriving by boat and resettled in other countries from ever entering Australia. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reported, ministers say the measure would stop migrants from using the so-called back door into the country.
There's been mounting pressure on Australia's centre-right government to give refuge to more than 50 child migrants held on Nauru. Some have been detained on the tiny South Pacific Republic for 5 years. The island of Nauru is host to an Australian-sponsored detention facility. Doctors have been expressing increasingly grave fears for the children's mental and physical health. The government says it's willing to allow asylum seekers and refugees on Nauru to start new lives in other countries. The United States has an agreement to resettle hundreds of migrants held in Australian offshore processing centres. New Zealand too has offered a home to 150 refugees. There is, though, a condition to Australia's acquiescence. Any migrant resettled in a third country would never be allowed to enter Australia. Canberra argues this would maintain the integrity of a border protection policy that's designed to deter unauthorised boat arrivals. The opposition Labour Party says it will now support the legislation, but only for those refugees being sent to New Zealand from Australia's controversial offshore processing centre on the island of Nauru. Peter Dutton, Australia's Home Affairs Minister, says Labour's approach is flawed.
Let me say this, Mr Speaker. There are 13 children on Nauru at the moment that are involved in family groups. Adults, mostly males, within that family unit are the subject of adverse security assessments from the United States. Now, the first question, Mr Speaker, is New Zealand going to take those people where the United States has advised that that person, that individual in the family unit, is a risk to national security?
Labour's immigration spokesman Shane Newman says the well-being of vulnerable children is his priority.
Labour thinks that we need to prioritise the health and welfare of these children and their families in Nauru, and that's why Labour's been prepared to move its position in this respect.
More than 200 detainees are held in Nauru. Under strict border control laws, Canberra seeks to deny them resettlement in Australia, even if their refugee claims are genuine. Australia argues that offshore processing is a powerful deterrent for migrants risking their lives at sea, often trying to make the journey on rickety fishing boats from Indonesia. Rights groups have consistently claimed conditions are cruel and inhumane. A second offshore centre at Manus Island in Papua New Guinea closed last year after local judges said it was unconstitutional. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Taiwan, normally quiet in the 10-6-way South China Sea sovereignty dispute, is likely to raise suspicion among the other claimants with a live fire drill near the sea's biggest natural island. A spokesman said last Monday the Taiwanese Coast Guard will conduct routine live fire exercises November 21st through the 23rd around Taiping Island in the Spratly Archipelago. Taiwan's Ministry of National Defense declined to say whether Navy units would participate. Because Taiwan normally says little in the broader South China Sea dispute, as it controls just two of about 500 tiny islands and has no formal diplomatic relations with the other five claimants, its activity may cause pushback as other disputants, including China, try to get along better. Oh Yi-sun teaches international studies at Singapore Nanyang University.
I don't really know what is meant by routine here, but if it is some sort of military exercise, I don't think it is routine. That would definitely upset the status quo. You have to prepare to face the consequences. That means others would also stage similar exercises, and there'll be a new round of mutual condemnations and so on.
Brunei, Malaysia, the Philippines, and Vietnam claim parts of the 3.5 million square kilometer sea that is prized for fisheries and undersea fuel reserves. China and Taiwan claim all of it. China also claims Taiwan, which has been self-ruled since the 1940s. Beijing is currently working with Southeast Asian governments on a code of conduct to head off any mishaps. Taiwan is not a party to those talks because China doesn't recognize it as a separate country. On the country's news website, VN Express International, Vietnam's government denounced the live fire drill plans last week as a serious violation of Vietnamese sovereignty. Taiwan will use 40-millimeter grenade launchers and other weapons during a drill that will cover a radius of 8 kilometers. Vietnam went on to say the drills around Taiping Island threaten peace, stability, maritime safety and security, create tension and complicate the situation in the South China Sea. The United States does not claim the sea, but periodically does send ships and B-52 bombers in support of its policy that the sea should be open to freedom of navigation. China has irked other countries by installing military infrastructure on some of the islets under its control. Washington sees Taiwan as part of a network of Asian democracies that hope to contain China's expansion, and informal Taiwan-U.S. ties have improved under President Donald Trump. Beijing usually avoids challenging Taiwan's South China Sea activities, but has become increasingly testy toward Tsai's government over two-way issues. Fabrizio Basato, a Taiwan Strategy Research Association fellow specialized in Asia and the Pacific, says Taiwan's government may hope to show that President Tsai Ing-wen is committed to defending the South China Sea interest before midterm local elections on November 24th.
The exercises convey a message to the other claimants that Taipei is willing and ready to defend its territorial integrity. Also, the exercises are a way to show to the United States and the other powers and to other countries upholding the principle of freedom of navigation in the South China Sea that Taiwan is willing to do its part.
In 2016, Taiwan's Coast Guard and Navy held search and rescue exercises near Taipang Island. A year earlier, Taiwan had positioned itself as a humanitarian player in the maritime sovereignty dispute and urged all countries to share resources. Live fire drills are useful given Taiping's size, says Andrew Yang, Secretary General of the Chinese Council of Advanced Policy Studies think tank in Taiwan. He said they're also routine, as are protests from Vietnam.
Geographically, the island is so small, and actually it's difficult to defend. I think it's a limited show of resolve in terms of defending the island.
Taiwan Defense Ministry spokesman Chen Chung-Chi said Monday the government sees Taiping as a humanitarian rescue center, but that any military participation in drills next month would be for security purposes. The island, 400 meters wide and 1,400 meters long, has a 10-bed hospital and airstrip at a pier. Our thanks go to Ralph Jennings in Taipei for contributing to the story. Thank you for being with us on VOA Asia Weekend. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. It may surprise you, cement is responsible for 7% of the world's carbon emissions. That's because it takes a lot of heat to produce the basic powdery base of cement that eventually becomes concrete. But it turns out that simple fibers from carrots could not only reduce that carbon footprint, but also make concrete stronger. The concrete details here from VOA's Kevin Enox.
The simple carrot is a good source of vitamin A, but this fibrous root vegetable may also be an ally in the fight against climate change. Scientists from Lancaster University, working with a Scottish firm, mashed up a lot of carrots to extract nanoplatelets, linked chains of atoms that are hard to break apart. Adding this carrot extract to cement mixtures makes the resulting concrete a whole lot stronger.
Our preliminary results show that adding about half a kilogram of carrot nanomaterial will reduce about 10 kilograms of cement per one cubic concrete.
The nanoplatelets increase the amount of calcium silicate hydrate in concrete. That's what makes concrete strong. In stress tests, the carrot concrete performed extremely well.
It makes the concrete more stronger, we found out that you could increase the strength by 80% by using a small amount of this new material.
That's not all the team at Lancaster University came up with. In a separate study, the team created another kind of cement that adds highly conductive potassium to the mixture. Add a few bronze wires and these little blocks become little concrete batteries. By connecting them to solar panels, bridges could hold a charge long enough to power their own lights at night and monitor their own structural health.
In addition to storing energy, these batteries could be used as self-sensors. Essentially, you can embed them into a structure like a bridge or a wind turbine to detect the cracks produced, you know, by winds or heavy traffic in a bridge.
That's a huge and exciting idea. But what these researchers have discovered could greatly reduce the carbon footprint of cement, and that could have a concrete impact in the fight against global warming. Kevin Enox, VOA News.
Last Tuesday, Indonesian divers resumed the search for the cockpit recorders so investigators could determine why Lion Air Flight JT-10 crashed in the Java Sea Monday, as the pilot tried to return to Jakarta Airport shortly after taking off. All 189 people on board are presumed dead. Only debris and body parts have been found and removed for identification. Contact with the Boeing 737 MAX 8 was lost 13 minutes after it lifted off on its way to Pangkal Pinang. The crash site is about 15 kilometers from shore and water up to 35 meters deep. Investigators are trying to figure out why the pilot radioed for permission to return to the airport. There was no distress signal. The chief of Lion Air Group said the plane suffered a technical problem on a previous flight from Bali to Jakarta on Sunday, but it had been resolved according to procedure. John Cox, the CEO of the Washington-based Safety Operating Systems Aviation Consultancy, spoke with VOA's Victor Beatty about the crash and the Boeing 737, a widely used aircraft that has been constantly upgraded and improved since the 1960s.
So this is a proven airframe. It's a proven workhorse. And this is the most modern, up-to-date electronics, computers, and engines, the most fuel-efficient model of the 737. So it has quite a lengthy history that investigators will, of course, look at. The area around Indonesia in general can be very challenging in that there are mountains and some of the islands are pretty remote. It has beautiful resorts such as Bali. It has not got the most extensive infrastructure system, so it can be a challenging area for pilots. But fortunately, the newer generation airplanes, such as the 737 MAX 8, have got onboard flight computers that make the job of navigating a good bit simpler.
Well, John, the weather apparently was not a factor. It was clear at takeoff. Data from Flight Radar 24 showed the first sign of something amiss about 2 minutes into the flight when the plane reached about 2,000 feet or 600 meters. It descended more than 150 meters, veered to the left before climbing again, where it stayed during most of the rest of the flight. Does that give you any clues?
The first thing is, as an accident investigator, you have to really validate the data. So the initial raw data says that the airplane descended. Maybe it did, maybe it didn't. We need to validate those data points. But there is indication that it climbed to 5,000 feet, and that would be normal if the crew were having some type of abnormality. That's a good altitude. You're well away from the ground, and it gives you an opportunity to go through the checklist, to do the problem solving necessary. They determined that they wanted to return back to Jakarta. They didn't declare an emergency, which all of this says that they were handling the situation. They didn't feel that they were in imminent danger, and they did exactly what they're trained to do. They methodically went through the checklist. What went wrong after that, and the investigators will look very carefully at, but those answers we don't have yet.
The aircraft, after the ascent and the turnaround, began actually gaining speed in the final moments, reaching 345 knots before data was lost when it was at about 1,100 meters. Does that give you any further clues, or we're just going to have to wait for the black boxes to be recovered?
First, the recorders will tell us the entire story, but the limited data that we have, one of the things that struck me was, why is the speed so high? And if, in fact, that turns out to be true, then that will help the investigators understand that whatever was wrong in those last, say, 20 seconds of the flight, something appears to be terribly wrong here. And the investigators are going to look for what could possibly have caused such a very rapid descent rate at such a high speed.
John Cox said the Indonesian aviation industry has been reviewed carefully by the European Union and U.S. Federal Aviation Administration withdrew their authority to fly. He said Lion Air, a relatively new carrier, had upgraded its safety protocols to allow it to fly in European airspace. Cox said it's too early to draw any conclusions about whether Flight JT610 was the victim of a systemic problem in Indonesian aviation. Thanks for being with us on VOA Asia Weekend. In Sri Lanka Tuesday, a warning from the parliament speaker of street violence unless the parliament is allowed to choose one of two rival prime ministers in a political dispute sparked by President Maithripala Sirisena's decision to sack the prime minister and replace him with the former president, Mahinda Rajapaksa. The president also suspended parliament. There is some question whether this is a power struggle between rivals India and China, which has had growing influence since Rajapaksa ushered in billions of Chinese investment to rebuild after a 26-year Tamil insurgency was defeated. The RAND Corporation Director of Asia-Pacific Policy and Senior Economist Rafiq Dosani comments on whether New Delhi and Beijing played any part in this constitutional dispute.
Not directly. I don't think that China put Rajapaksa up to this or that India put Vikramasinghe up to this. I think the problem is largely domestic, where Sirisena and Vikramasinghe, the president and the prime minister, have been increasingly at odds on domestic politics. And this might have to do with the reality that with elections about a year and a half away, they come from different parties and will be contending for power possibly at that time. So I think looking at that and looking at Rajapaksa's success in local elections earlier this year, where both the parties of Sirisena and that of Vikramasinghe lost heavily, I think precipitated this.
Mr. Rajapaksa has been close to Beijing, opening ports to Chinese vessels, which Dasani said has been happening historically.
Sri Lanka has always had, for many years, ports in Colombo have been built by China and by other parties, not Indian, but various groups, including Western groups and Chinese groups, have built ports in Sri Lanka very successfully. The issue is the Hambantota port, which I think you're referring to, which is in the south of the country and is a white elephant that China built at Rajapaksa's request and took on, you know, and for which the country took on a debt of $1 billion. So that's something that remains unresolved in the sense that Sri Lanka then gave the port away to the Chinese in return for the debt. So the Chinese are now stuck with a white elephant, not quite sure what to do with it. And so that's what's creating the problem between them.
The parliament speaker warned the situation should be settled through the parliament, but if not, he said it would be taken to the streets, where there would be a huge bloodbath. Dasani does not agree that would be the result.
Unfortunately, the situation in Sri Lanka is quite polarized right now, with Rajapaksa, who's much more hardline, having won in the local elections basically by raising fears about the right. You know, he comes from a much more conservative, hardline background, and the basis on which he took charge and then successfully solved the Tamil insurgency, which was through hardline methods, are what people are fearing. And then when he was in power, he was a difficult prime minister, clamping down on the press and on freedoms generally. So I think people have memories of that, but at the same time, he won local elections. I think if he wins, if he comes into power, there won't be a bloodbath. People will give him a chance to prove his majority.
Rafiq Dasani said he's hopeful this dispute will be resolved peacefully. Ultimately, he said, the removal of the prime minister must be validated by parliament. Dasani cautioned parliament's suspension till November 16th may have to be adjudicated before the country's Supreme Court. Pakistan's Supreme Court Wednesday overturned the conviction of a Christian woman on a charge of committing blasphemy, a crime punishable by death under Pakistani law. The landmark ruling sparked protests by hardline Islamists and raised fears of violence. The prosecution has categorically failed to prove its case beyond a reasonable doubt, read the verdict in the case of Asia Bibi. Several Islamist parties rejected the verdict. One of them, the Defense of Pakistan Council, announced it will now take matters in its own hands. I asked Waris Hussain, policy analyst for South Asia with the United States Commission on International Religious Freedom, to explain what happened.
Essentially, what happened here is something that happens to a lot of religious minorities in Pakistan. There was some kind of a conflict, some kind of a fight, a war of words, so to speak, between Asia Bibi, who was essentially a field worker, and other field workers who were picking berries, essentially. And during this berry picking, there was an issue over the collection of water, the drinking of water. Sometimes Muslims, or some Muslims, say that I can't drink this from the same water source as a Christian. So there was an issue of that. And then there was a back and forth between Asia Bibi and two women from her village. And then those women took that personal sort of issue that didn't have anything to do really with religion, so to speak, but then they took that fight that they had to their local imam. The imam then went to file a first information report, which is essentially a criminal report, against Asia for committing blasphemy. She was beaten by her village, people within her village, after the accusation went out. Then she was arrested. She was charged in the Sessions Court. Then the Lahore High Court upheld that conviction and held her for the death sentence. And then finally, the Supreme Court stayed her execution in 2016. And then finally, in 2018, they've actually acquitted her of all charges, and she's now free to go and perhaps leave the country even if she needs to.
Those of us in the Western world are accustomed to a separation of church and state. Is that not the case in Pakistan and many other places around the world?
No, especially not oftentimes in the Muslim world. Pakistan is technically and constitutionally designated as the Islamic Republic of Pakistan. So you can already see in the name and the branding of the country itself at its outset, it's not supposed to be secular, or the separation between church and state isn't quite how we see it in the West. And therefore, we do see that Sharia and Islamic law does have a sort of importance in the Pakistani political system, and also Islamic parties and Islamist parties have a very, very strong hold, not because they can get election, they can win elections necessarily, but they really have strong connections with major political parties that do win elections. And so they kind of dictate to those parties, here's what's possible for you as Muslims, here's what's not permissible for you as Muslims. And once they've said something's not permissible, it's very hard to convince them otherwise.
This is quite surprising in Pakistan, is it not?
It is quite surprising, also because in previous cases when judges have acquitted people of blasphemy, or have sort of even the opposite, when a religious minority is attacked by a terrorist, even convicting that terrorist of a crime can actually endanger the life of judges. So here in this case, the Supreme Court justices, including the Chief Justice as well as Justice Khosa, have taken an action that could potentially lead to them being attacked, whether in the public sphere or whether actually physically attacked by religious extremist groups. And it's happened before with judges in the past, where judges who have sort of come out in favor of religious minorities actually have to flee the country because they're so afraid of the response.
But what about Ms. Beebe? Is she in danger?
I think reasonably and rationally looking at this, absolutely she's in danger. I don't know exactly where she is right now. Hopefully, and I'm hoping, and I have no information on this, but I'm hoping she's out of the country because that's the best way to keep her safe. But definitely she's in danger. Her family and her extended family are also in danger. Her attorney is also in danger. And also the Pakistani Christian community overall is in danger, because if oftentimes when the extremist groups can't get their hands on the person they want to get their hands on, they take out their aggression or violence on the community at large. So they'll go to a Christian village or neighborhood, burn it down, ransack it, loot it, if they can't find the one Christian that they were looking for. So in this case, if Asia Bibi has found safety, which I hope she has outside the country, there are still other collateral damage that might happen between her extended family, that many of them are still in Pakistan, and Christians overall in Pakistan who are still there.
Pakistan's Prime Minister Imran Khan warned what he called a handful of protesters across the country not to take the state on over the landmark Supreme Court verdict. Did that surprise you, and does that put him in danger?
It absolutely surprised me. I think in some ways it does put him in danger, but he also has quite a lot of public support these days. And in fact, he has support amongst many young religious people, such that if he said this, they might listen to him over other religious extremist preachers who might be arguing against him in this instance. One thing I would sort of just mention is that this is, I think, a really important moment for Pakistan, because this is really a decision by Pakistanis, for Pakistanis, about Pakistan. You know, there's going to be accusations, and there have been accusations in the past, that any kind of progress that's been made or is made on religious minority issues is actually only being done on the behest of the United States or on Europe or et cetera, et cetera. But I think here what we have is the Pakistani Supreme Court, a very Pakistani institution, deciding something, the Prime Minister going along with it, and the police and security forces going along with it. So it's a completely, I think, really organic Pakistani development, and I think for that reason it should be really held as a really good example of where things can go in the future to try and change things and to try and make them more equal or fair for religious minorities. This isn't an outside influence that's being pushed on Pakistan. This is Pakistanis saying, we've got to do better, and we will do better.
Waris Hussain, policy analyst for South Asia with the United States Commission on International Religious Freedom. We are happy you're with us on VOA Asia Weekend. The UN Refugee Agency opposes a recent agreement between Myanmar and Bangladesh to begin repatriating thousands of Rohingya refugees in the coming weeks. The UNHCR says conditions are not conducive for the safe, dignified return of the refugees to a country they fled more than a year ago to escape persecution and violence. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from UNHCR headquarters in Geneva.
The decision to begin the repatriation operation in mid-November comes about a week after UN investigators have warned of an ongoing genocide in Myanmar. Bangladesh reportedly handed over to Myanmar the names of more than 5,000 Rohingya refugees who had been processed for return. UN refugee spokesman Andrei Mihajic says Myanmar reportedly agreed to the list. He tells VOA the Bangladeshi authorities must inform the refugees of this transaction and they must be consulted on whether or not they would like to return to Myanmar.
UNHCR was not involved in preparation, transmission or receipt of this list, nor in the verification and clearing that was reportedly carried out by the government of Myanmar. Because we considered that conditions in Rakhine State are not yet conducive for voluntary return in the conditions of safety, dignity and sustainability, UNHCR will not at this stage facilitate any refugee returns to Rakhine State.
More than 700,000 Rohingya fled to Cox's Bazar at the end of August 2017 in the wake of a brutal crackdown by the Myanmar military, including killings, rapes, and arson attacks. The United Nations reports Rohingya continue to flee Myanmar. It says more than 14,000 refugees have arrived in Bangladesh this year. The Rohingya have lived as a stateless people in Myanmar for more than six generations. UNHCR's Mihajic says it is up to the Myanmar authorities to create the conditions for refugee returns. He says that includes granting the Rohingya citizenship, freedom of movement, access to education, and other basic services and rights available to the rest of the population. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
During every election season, as many American citizens prepare to go to the polls, one group of immigrants has traditionally chosen not to get involved. The Cambodian community in the United States has been fearful of the government because of its past. But this midterm election is different. The largest Cambodian community in the U.S. is taking political action. VOA's Elizabeth Lee has their story from Long Beach, California.
This is a place of refuge for genocide survivors who are seeking peace.
I experienced extreme violence. I saw extreme violence where my mother was beaten to near death.
Demand your rights.
Laura Som founded the May Center to help survivors of the Cambodian genocide heal from the trauma of the Khmer Rouge's reign of terror. The communist regime killed roughly 2 million people. Here, students can take a civics class, a topic dear to Som, who says her father was murdered in Cambodia because he was against the government.
I spend my entire life, from then until now, to learn and heal myself so I could be civically involved, because I know that's the only way.
Som was teaching civics when her student V. Sarong asked the question that started a movement.
I asked the question of why Cambodian community doesn't have such political voice.
Members of the Cambodian community traditionally have not participated in local government or voted. The reason, says Charles Song, is fear.
Most of us didn't have a say back in our country because we live under so oppressive government that any say would probably end up with missing, you know, your brother and sister and all that.
Cambodian Americans make up about 4% of the total population in Long Beach. More than half of them live in and near an area called Cambodia Town. This area is divided into four districts with four representatives. The Cambodian community has gathered thousands of signatures asking city officials to redraw district lines so Cambodia Town is consolidated into one district with one representative who understands its special needs.
We're people of the earth. We want plants and gardens. This is how we heal ourselves. But yet we are put into a community where it's a cement jungle.
Civil rights attorney Mark Coleman says other ethnic minority groups have succeeded at redistricting.
The Latino community did the same thing, and they created what more or less has been called a Latino district.
The Cambodian community is also supporting an item on the November ballot calling for an independent citizens group to redistrict the city after the 2020 census instead of having city officials draw the lines. Redistricting of the city will not be considered, said city officials, until after the 2020 census to get the most accurate population count. Song says he will keep fighting. He has survived much worse.
And that survival mode can only be used as a tool.
Let's help.
For many genocide survivors, this fight for representation is one step towards finding peace from their painful past. Elizabeth Lee, VOA News, Long Beach, California.
We hope you have enjoyed VOA Asia Weekend. Please join us again next weekend. I'm Ira Melman in Washington.